to go. Bajan's new insistence could mean nothing good for her. I have to get out of this trap, she thought, before this creature lures me with memories and sympathy. Maybe Kaz and the others were coming for her, but she didn't intend to wait around and see. Once Bajan and the guards had left, she slipped the shard of broken bowl from where she'd hidden it beneath the ropes around her ankles and set to work. Weak and wobbly as she'd felt when Bajan had arrived with that heavenly-smelling bowl of mush, she'd only pretended to swoon so that she could deliberately knock her tray off the table. If Vanek had really done his research, he would have warned Bajan that the wraith did not fall, certainly not in a clumsy heap on the floor where she could easily tuck a sharp piece of crockery between her bonds. After what seemed like a lifetime of sawing and scraping and bloodying her fingertips on the shard's edge, she had finally severed her ropes and freed her hands, then untied her ankles and felt her way to the vent. Bajan and the guards wouldn't be back until morning. That gave her the whole night to escape this place and get as far away as she possibly could. The passage was a miserably tight fit, the air inside musty with smells she couldn't quite identify, the dark so complete she might as well have kept her blindfold on. She had no idea where the vent might lead. It could run for a few more feet or for half a mile. She needed to be gone by morning or they'd find the grating that covered the vent loosened on its hinges and know exactly where she was. Good luck getting me out, she thought grimly. She doubted any of Vanek's guards could squeeze inside the air shaft. They'd have to find some kitchen boy and grease him down with lard. She inched forward. How far had she gone? Every time she took a deep breath, it felt like the air shaft was tightening around her ribs. For all she knew, she could be atop a building. She might pop her head out the other side, only to find a busy Ketterdam street far below. Inej could contend with that. But if the shaft just ended? If it was walled up on the other side? She'd have to squirm backward the entire distance and hope to refasten her ropes so that her captors wouldn't know what she'd done. Impossible. There could be no dead ends tonight. Faster, she told herself, sweat beating on her brow. It was hard not to imagine the building compressing around her, its walls squeezing the breath from her lungs. She couldn't make a real plan until she reached the end of this tunnel, until she knew just how far she'd have to go to evade Vanek's men. Then she felt it. The barest gust of air brushing against her damp forehead. She whispered a quick prayer of thanks. There must be some kind of opening up ahead. She sniffed, searching for a hint of coal smoke or the wet green fields of a country town. Cautiously, she wiggled forward until her fingers made contact with the slats of the vent. There was no light trickling through, which she supposed was a good thing. The room she was about to drop into must be unoccupied. Saints, what if she was in Vanek's mansion? What if she was about to land on a sleeping merch? She listened for some human sound. Snores. Deep breathing. Nothing. She wished for her knives, for the comforting weight of them in her palms. Did Vanek still have them in his possession? Had he sold them off? Tossed them into the sea? She named the blades anyway. Peter. Maria. Anastasia. Lizabetta. Sankt Vladimir. Sankta Alina. And found courage in each whispered word. Then she jiggled the vent and gave it a hard shove. It flew open, but instead of swinging on its hinges, it came completely loose. She tried to grab it, but it slid past her fingertips and clattered to the floor. Inej waited, heart pounding. A minute passed in silence. Another. No one came. The room was empty. Maybe the whole building was empty. Vanek wouldn't have left her unguarded, so his men must be stationed outside. If that was the case, she knew slipping past them would present little challenge, and at least now she knew roughly how far away the floor was. There was no graceful way to accomplish what came next. She slid down head first, gripping the wall. Then, when she was more than halfway out and her body began to tip, she let momentum carry her forward, curling into a ball and tucking her arms over her head to protect her skull and neck as she fell. The impact was fairly painless. The floor was hard concrete, like the floor of her cell. But she rolled as she struck, and came up against what seemed to be the back of something solid. She pulled herself to her feet, hands exploring whatever she'd banged into. It was upholstered in velvet. As she moved along, she felt another identical object next to it. Seats, she realized. I'm in a theater. There were plenty of music halls and theaters in the barrel. Could she be so close to home? Or maybe in one of the respectable opera houses of the Lid? She moved slowly, hands out before her, until she reached a wall at what she thought was the back of the theater. She groped along it, seeking a door, a window, even another vent. Finally, her fingers hooked over the door frame, and her hands wrapped around the knob. It wouldn't budge. Locked. She gave it a tentative rattle. The room flooded with light. Inez shrank back against the door, squinting in the sudden brightness.
If you wanted a tour, Miss Gaffar, you might simply have asked, said Jan van Eck.
He stood on the stage of the decrepit theater, his black merchant's suit cut in severe lines. The theater's green velvet seats were moth-eaten. The curtains bracketing the stage hung in shreds. No one had bothered to take down the set from the last play. It looked like a child's terrified version of a surgeon's operating room. Oversized saws and mallets hanging from the walls. Inej recognized it as the set for The Madman and the Doctor, one of the short plays from the Comédie Brute. Guards were stationed around the room, and Bajan stood beside Van Eck, wringing his elegant hands. Had the vent been left open to tempt her? Had Van Eck been toying with her all along?
Bring her here, Van Eck told the guards.
Inej didn't hesitate. She sprang onto the narrow back of the nearest theater seat, then raced toward the stage, leaping from row to row as the guards tried to scramble over the seats. She vaulted onto the stage, past a startled Van Eck, neatly skirting two more guards, and seized one of the stage ropes, shinnying up its length, praying it would hold her weight until she made it to the top. She could hide in the rafters, find a way to the roof.
Cut her down, Van Eck called,
his voice calm. Inej climbed higher, faster, but seconds later she saw a face above her, one of Van Eck's guards, a knife in his hand. He slashed through the rope. It gave way and Inej fell to the floor, softening her knees to take the impact. Before she could right herself, three guards were on her, holding her in place.
Really, Miss Gaffar,
Van Eck chided.
We're well aware of your gifts. Did you think I wouldn't take precautions?
He did not wait for an answer.
You are not going to find your way out of this without my help, or Mr. Brecker's. As he does not seem to be making an appearance, perhaps you should consider a change in alliance.
Inej said nothing. Van Eck tucked his hands behind his back. It was strange to look at him and see the ghost of Weiland's face.
The city is awash in rumors of Parem. A delegation of Fjerdin Druskala has arrived at the embassy sector. Today the Shu sailed two warships into Third Harbor. I gave Brecker 7 days to broker a trade for your safety. But they are all looking for Kue Yulbo. And it is imperative that I get him out of the city before they find him.
Two Shu warships. That was what had changed. Van Eck was out of time. Had Bajan known it or simply sensed the difference in his master's mood?
I had hoped Bajan might prove good for something other than bettering my wife's talent at the pianoforte,
Van Eck continued.
But it seems you and I must now come to an arrangement. Where is Kaz Brecker keeping the boy?
How could I possibly know that?
You must know the locations of the dregs' safe houses. Brecker does nothing without preparation. He'll have warrants to hide in all over the city.
If you know him so well, then you know he'd never keep Kue somewhere that I could lead you to him.
I don't believe that.
I can't help what you do or don't believe. Your shoe scientist is probably long gone already.
Word would have reached me. My spies are everywhere.
Clearly not everywhere. Bajan's lips quirked. Van Eck shook his head wearily.
Get her on the table.
Inej knew it was pointless to struggle. But she did anyway. It was fight or give in to the terror that rushed through her as the guards hefted her onto the table and pinned down her limbs. Now she saw one of the prop tables was set with instruments that looked nothing like the oversized mallets and saws hanging from the walls. They were real surgeons' tools, scalpels, and saws, and clamps that gleamed with sinister intent.
"You are the Wraith, Miss Scaffar. Legend of the Barrel. You've gathered the secrets of judges, councilmen, thieves, and killers alike. I doubt there is anything in this city you do not know. You will tell me the locations of Mr. Brecker's safe houses now."
"I can't tell you what I don't know," Van Eck sighed.
"Remember that I have tried to treat you with civility."
He turned to one of the guards, a heavy-set man with a sharp blade of a nose.
"I'd prefer this didn't go on too long. Do what you think is best."
The guard let his hand hover over the table of instruments as if deciding which cruelty would be most efficient. Inej felt her courage wobble, her breath coming in panicked gasps.
"When fear arrives, something is about to happen."
Bajan leaned over her, face pale, eyes full of concern.
"Please, tell him. Surely Brecker isn't worth being scarred or maimed. Tell him what you know."
"All I know is that men like you don't deserve the air they breathe." Bajan looked stung.
"I've been nothing but kind to you. I'm not some sort of monster."
"No. You're the man who sits idly by, congratulating yourself on your decency, while the monster eats his fill. At least the monster has teeth and a spine."
"That isn't fair."
Inej couldn't believe the softness of this creature, that he would bid for her approval in this moment.
"If you still believe in fairness, then you've led a very lucky life. Get out of the monster's way, Bajan. Let's get this over with."
The blade-nosed guard stepped forward. Something gleamed in his hand. Inej reached for a place of stillness inside of herself, the place that had allowed her to endure a year at the menagerie, a year of nights marked by pain and humiliation, of days counted in beatings and worse. "Go on," she urged. And her voice was steel.
"Wait,"
said Van Eck. He was studying Inej as if he were reading a ledger, trying to make the figures line up. He cocked his head to one side and said,
"Break her legs."
Inej felt her courage fracture. She began to thrash, trying to get free of the guard's hold.
"Ah," said Van Eck. "That's what I thought."
The blade-nosed guard selected a heavy length of pipe.
"No,"
said Van Eck.
"I don't want it to be a clean break. Use the mallet. Shatter the bone."
His face hovered above her, his eyes a bright, clear blue. Wyland's eyes, but devoid of any of Wyland's kindness.
"No one will be able to put you back together again, Miss Gaffar. Maybe you can earn your way out of your contract by begging for pennies on East Stave, and then crawl home to the Slat every night, assuming Brecker still gives you a room there."
"Don't!"
She didn't know if she was pleading with Van Eck or herself. She didn't know who she hated more in this moment. The guard took up a steel mallet. Inej writhed on the table, her body coated in sweat. She could smell her own fear.
"Don't!" she repeated. "Don't!"
The blade-nosed guard tested the mallet's weight in his hand. Van Eck nodded. The guard lifted it in a smooth arc. Inej watched the mallet rise and reach its apex, light glinting off its wide head, the flat face of a dead moon. She heard the crackle of the campfire, thought of her mother's hair twined with persimmon silk.
"He'll never trade if you break me!"
she screamed, the words tearing loose from some deep place inside her, her voice raw and undefended.
"I'll be no use to him anymore."
Van Eck held up a hand. The mallet fell. Inej felt it brush against her trousers as the impact shattered the surface of the table, a hair's breadth from her calf, the entire corner collapsing beneath the force.
"My leg," she thought, shuddering violently. "That would have been my leg."
There was a metallic taste in her mouth. She'd bitten her tongue.
Saints, protect me. Saints, protect me.
You make an interesting argument,
Van Eck said, meditatively. He tapped a finger against his lips, thinking.
Ponder your loyalties, Miss Scaffar. Tomorrow night, I may not be so merciful.
Inej could not control her shaking. I'm going to cut you open, she vowed silently. I'm going to excavate that pathetic excuse of a heart from your chest. It was an evil thought, a vile thought, but she couldn't help it. Would her saints sanction such a thing? Could forgiveness come if she killed not to survive, but because she burned with living, luminous hatred? I don't care, she thought, as her body spasmed and the guards lifted her trembling form from the table. I'll do penance for the rest of my days, if it means I get to kill him. They dragged her back to her room through the lobby of the dilapidated theater, and down a hall to what she now knew must be an old equipment room. They bound her hands and feet again. Bajan moved to place the blindfold over her eyes. I'm sorry, he whispered. I didn't know he intended... I...
Cut him on the hem. Bajan flinched.
Don't say that.
The Suli were a close people, loyal. They had to be in a world where they had no land and where they were so very few. Inej's teeth were chattering, but she forced out the words.
You are forsaken.
As you have turned your back on me, so will they turn their backs on you. It was the worst of Suli denunciations, one that forbade you the welcome of your ancestors in the next world, and doomed your spirit to wander without a home. Bajan paled.
I don't believe any of that.
You will. He secured the blindfold around her head. She heard the door close. Inej lay on her side, her hip and her shoulder digging into the hard floor, and waited for the tremors to pass. In her early days at the menagerie, she believed someone would come for her. Her family would find her. An officer of the law. A hero from one of the stories her mother used to tell. Men had come, but not to set her free. And eventually her hope had withered like leaves beneath a too bright sun, replaced by a bitter bud of resignation. Kaz had rescued her from that hopelessness, and their lives had been a series of rescues ever since, a string of debts that they never tallied, as they saved each other again and again. Lying in the dark, she realized that for all her doubts, she'd believed he would rescue her once more, that he would put aside his greed and his demons, and come for her. Now she wasn't so sure, because it was not just the sense in the words she'd spoken that had stilled Van Eck's hand, but the truth he'd heard in her voice. He'll never trade if you break me. She could not pretend those words had been conjured by strategy or even animal cunning. The magic they'd worked had been born of belief, an ugly enchantment.
Tomorrow night, I may not be so merciful.
Had tonight been an exercise meant to frighten her? Or would Van Eck return to carry out his threats? And if Kaz did come, how much of her would be left? Part 2. A Killing Wind.
5. Jesper. Jesper felt like his clothes were crawling with fleas. Whenever the crew left Black Veil Island to skulk around the barrel, they wore the costumes of the Comédie Brute. The capes, veils, masks, and occasionally horns that tourists and locals alike used to disguise their identities while enjoying the pleasures of the barrel. But here, on the respectable avenues and canals of the university district, Mr. Crimson and the Grey Imp would have drawn a lot of stares. So he and Wylan had ditched their costumes as soon as they were clear of the staves, and if Jesper was honest with himself, he didn't want to meet his father for the first time in years dressed in a goggle-eyed mask or an orange silk cape, or even his usual barrel flash. He'd dressed as respectably as he could. Wylan had lent him a few krug for a second-hand tweed jacket and a gloomy gray waistcoat. He didn't look precisely reputable, but students weren't supposed to look too prosperous anyway. Once again, he found himself reaching for his revolvers, longing for the cool, familiar feel of their pearl handles beneath his thumbs. That skiv of a lawyer had ordered the floor boss to store them in a safe at the Cumulus. Kaz said they'd get back in good time, but he doubted Kaz would be so calm and collected if someone had swiped his cane. "You're the one who put them on the table like a nub," Jesper reminded himself. He'd done it for Inej, and if he was honest, he'd done it for Kaz, too, to show he was willing to do what it took to make things right. Not that it seemed to matter much. "Well," he consoled himself, "it's not like I could have worn my revolvers on this errand anyway." Students and professors didn't go from class to class packing powder. Might make for a more interesting school day if they did. Even so, Jesper had hidden a sad lump of a pistol beneath his coat. This was Ketterdam, after all, and it was possible he and Wylan were walking into a trap. That was why Kaz and Matthias were shadowing their steps. He'd seen no sign of either of them, and Jesper supposed that was a good thing. But he was still grateful Wylan had offered to come along. Kaz had only allowed it because Wylan said he needed supplies for his work on the Weevil. They walked past student cafes and booksellers, shop windows crammed with textbooks, ink, and paper. They were less than 2 miles from the noise and clatter of the barrel, but it felt like they'd crossed a bridge into another country. Instead of packs of sailors fresh off the boats looking for trouble, or tourists jostling into you from every angle, people stepped aside to let you pass, kept their conversations low. No barkers shouted from storefronts hoping to garner business. The crooked little alleys were full of bookbinders and apothecaries, and the corners were free of the girls and boys who lacked an association with one of the West Stave houses and who had been forced to ply their trade on the street. Jesper paused below an awning and took a deep breath through his nose. "What?" asked Wylan. "It smells so much better here. Expensive tobacco. Morning rain still damp on the cobblestones. Blue clouds of hyacinths in the window boxes. No urine, no vomit, no cheap perfume or garbage rot. Even the tang of coal smoke seemed fainter." "Are you stalling?" Wylan asked. "No." Jesper exhaled and sagged a bit. "Maybe a little." Roddy had taken a message to the hotel where the man claiming to be Jesper's father was staying, so they could set a time and place to meet. Jesper had wanted to go himself, but if his father really was in Ketterdam, it was possible he was being used as bait. Better to meet in broad daylight, on neutral ground. The university had seemed safest, far away from the dangers of the barrel or any of Jesper's usual stomping grounds. Jesper didn't know if he wanted his father to be waiting for him at the university or not. It was so much more pleasant to think of facing a fight than the shame of how horribly he'd botched everything. But talking about that felt like trying to climb a scaffold made of rotting boards. So he said, "I always liked this part of town. My father likes it too. He places a high value on learning." "Higher than money?" Wylan shrugged, eyeing a window full of hand-painted globes. "Knowledge isn't a sign of divine favor. Prosperity is." Jesper cast him a swift glance. He still wasn't used to Wylan's voice coming out of Kuwe's mouth. It always left him feeling a little off kilter, like he'd thought he was reaching for a cup of wine and gotten a mouthful of water instead. "Is your papa really that religious? Or is that just an excuse for being a mean son of a bitch when it comes to business?"
"When it comes to anything, really."
"Particularly thugs and canal rats from the barrel?" Wylan shifted the strap of his satchel. "He thinks the barrel distracts men from work and industry and leads to degeneracy." "He may have a point," said Jesper. He sometimes wondered what might have happened if he'd never gone out with his new friends that night, if he'd never walked into that gambling parlor and taken that first spin of the Macher's wheel. It was meant to be harmless fun, and for everyone else, it had been. But Jesper's life had split like a log into two distinct and uneven pieces. The time before he'd stepped up to that wheel, and every day since. The barrel eats people. Maybe, Weiland considered. But business is business. The gambling parlors and brothels meet a demand. They offer employment. They pay taxes. What a good little barrel boy you've become. That's practically a page out of the boss's books. Every few years, some reformer got it into his head to clean up the barrel and purge Ketterdam of its unsavory reputation. That was when the pamphlets came out. A war of propaganda between the owners of the gambling dens and pleasure houses on one side and the black-suited merch reformers on the other. In the end, it all came down to money. The businesses of East and West Stave turned a serious profit, and the denizens of the barrel dumped very righteous coin into the city's tax coffers. Weiland tugged on the satchel strap again. It had gotten twisted at the top. I don't think it's much different from wagering your fortune on a shipment of silk or jerda. Your odds are just a lot better when you're playing the market. You have my attention, Merchling. Better odds were always of interest. What's the most your father's ever lost on a trade? I don't really know. He stopped talking about those things with me a long time ago. Jesper hesitated. Jan van Eck was three kinds of fool for the way he treated his son. But Jesper could admit he was curious about Weiland's supposed affliction. He wanted to know what Weiland saw when he tried to read. Why he seemed fine with equations or prices on a menu, but not sentences or signs. Instead, he said, I wonder if proximity to the barrel makes merchers more uptight. All that black clothing and restraint. Meat only twice a week. Lager instead of brandy. Maybe they're making up for all the fun we're having.
Keeping the scales balanced?
Sure. I mean, just think of the heights of debauchery we could reach if no one kept this city in check. Champagne for breakfast. Naked orgies on the floor of the exchange. Weiland made a flustered noise that sounded like a bird with a cough and looked anywhere but at Jesper. He was so wonderfully easy to rattle. Though Jesper could admit, he didn't think the university district needed a dose of the dirty. He liked it just fine as it was, clean and quiet, and smelling of books and flowers. You don't have to come, you know, Jesper said, because he felt he should. You have your supplies. You could wait this out safe and snug in a coffee house.
Is that what you want?
No. I can't do this alone, Jesper shrugged. He wasn't sure how he felt about what Weiland might witness at the university. Jesper had rarely seen his father angry. But how could he fail to be angry now? What explanations could Jesper offer him? He'd lied, put the livelihood his father had worked so hard for into jeopardy. And for what? A steaming pile of nothing. But Jesper couldn't bear the thought of facing his father on his own. Inej would have understood. Not that he deserved her sympathy, but there was something steady in her that he knew would recognize and ease his own fears. He'd hoped that Kaz would offer to accompany him, but when they'd split up to approach the university, Kaz had spared him only one dark glance. The message had been clear. You dug this grave. Go lie in it. Kaz was still punishing him for the ambush that had nearly ended the ice court job before it began. And it was going to take more than Jesper sacrificing his revolvers for him to earn his way back into Kaz's good graces. Did Kaz even have good graces? Jesper's heart beat a little harder as they walked beneath the vast stone archway into the courtyard of the Bolksplein. The university wasn't one building, but a series of them, all built around parallel sections of the Bolk Canal and joined by Speaker's Bridge, where people met to debate or drink a friendly pint of lager, depending on the day of the week. But the Bolksplein was the heart of the university. Four libraries, built around a central courtyard and the Scholar's Fountain. It had been nearly 2 years since Jesper had set foot on university grounds. He'd never officially withdrawn from school. He hadn't even really decided not to attend. He'd simply started spending more and more time on East Stave, until he looked up one day and realized the barrel had become his home. Even so, in his brief time as a student, he'd fallen in love with the Bolksplein. Jesper had never been a great reader. He loved stories, but he hated sitting still. And the books assigned to him for school seemed designed to make his mind wander. At the Bolksplein, wherever his eyes strayed, there was something to occupy them. Leaded windows with stained glass borders. Iron gates worked into figures of books and ships. The central fountain with its bearded scholar. And best of all, the gargoyles. Bat-winged grotesques in mortarboard caps. And stone dragons falling asleep over books. He liked to think that whoever had built this place had known not all students were suited to quiet contemplation. But as they entered the courtyard, Jesper didn't look around to savor the stonework or listen to the splashing of the fountain. All his attention focused on the man standing near the eastern wall, gazing up at the stained glass windows, a crumpled hat clasped in his hands. With a pang, Jesper realized his father had worn his best suit. He'd combed his kalish red hair tidily back from his brow. There was gray in it now that hadn't been there when Jesper left home. Colm Fahy looked like a farmer on his way to church. Totally out of place. Kaz, hell, anyone in the barrel would take one look at him and just see a walking, talking target. Jesper's throat felt dry sand parched. "Da," he croaked. His father's head snapped up, and Jesper steeled himself for what might come next. Whatever insults or outrage his father hurled at him, he deserved. But he wasn't prepared for the relieved grin that split his father's craggy features. Someone might as well have put a bullet right in Jesper's heart. "Jess!" his father cried. And then Jesper was crossing the courtyard, and his father's arms were tight around him. Hugging him so hard, Jesper thought he actually felt his ribs bend. "All saints, I thought you were dead. They said you weren't a student here anymore. That you just vanished. And I was sure you'd been stuck through by bandits or the like in this saint-forsaken place." "I'm alive, Di," Jesper gasped. "But if you keep squeezing me like that, I won't be for long." His father laughed and released him, holding him at arm's length. Big hands on Jesper's shoulders. "I swear you're a foot taller." Jesper ducked his head. "Half a foot?" "This is Weilen," he said, switching from Zemini to Kirch. They'd spoken both at home, his mother's language and the language of trade. His father's native Kalish had been reserved for the rare times Colm sang. "Nice to meet you. Do you speak Kirch?" his father practically shouted, and Jesper realized it was because Weilen still looked like Shu. "Da," he said, cringing in embarrassment. "He speaks Kirch just fine." "Nice to meet you, Mr. Fahy," said Weilen. Bless his merch manners. "And you too, lad. Are you a student as well?" "I have studied," said Wylan, awkwardly. Jesper had no idea how to fill the silence that followed. He wasn't sure what he'd expected from this meeting with his father. But a friendly exchange of pleasantries wasn't it. Wylan cleared his throat. Are you hungry, Mr. Fahey?
Starving,
Jesper's father replied gratefully. Wylan gave Jesper a poke with his elbow. Maybe we could take your father to lunch.
Lunch,
Jesper said, repeating the word as if he'd just learned it.
Yes, lunch. Who doesn't like lunch?
Lunch felt like a miracle. They'd eat, they'd talk, maybe they'd drink. Please let them drink.
But, Jesper, what has been happening? I received a notice from the Gemmons Bank. The loan is coming due, and you'd given me to believe it was temporary, and your studies...
Duh, Jesper began.
The thing is, a shot rang out against the walls of the courtyard.
Jesper shoved his father behind him as a bullet pinged off the stones at their feet, sending up a cloud of dust. Suddenly, gunfire was echoing across the courtyard. The reverberation made it hard to tell where the shots were coming from.
What in the name of all that is holy?
Jesper yanked on his father's sleeve, pulling him toward the hooded stone shelter of a doorway. He looked to his left, prepared to grab hold of Wylan, but the merchling was already in motion, keeping pace beside Jesper in what passed for a reasonable crouch.
Nothing like being shot at a few times to make you a fast learner, Jesper thought as they reached the protective curve of the overhang.
He craned his neck to see up to the roofline, then flinched back as more shots rang out. Another smattering of gunfire rattled from somewhere above and to the left of them, and Jesper could only hope that meant Matthias and Kaz were returning fire.
Saints! His father gasped. This city is worse than the guidebook said.
Da.
It isn't the city, Jesper said, pulling the pistol from his coat. They're after me, or after us. Hard to say.
Who's after you?
Jesper exchanged a glance with Wylan.
Jan Van Eck? A rival gang looking to settle a score?
Pekka Rollins? Or someone else Jesper had borrowed money from?
There's a long list of potential suitors.
We need to get out of here before they introduce themselves more personally.
Brigands?
Jesper knew there was a good chance he was about to be riddled with holes, so he tried to restrain his grin. Something like that. He peered around the edge of the door, peeled off two shots, then ducked back when another spate of gunfire exploded.
Wylan, tell me you're packing more than pens, ink, and weevil makings.
I've got two flash bombs and something new I rigged up with a little more,
wallop? Bombs?
Jesper's father asked, blinking as if to wake himself from a bad dream. Jesper shrugged helplessly.
Think of them as science experiments?
What kind of numbers are we up against?
Asked Wylan.
Look at you asking all the right questions.
Hard to tell. They're somewhere on the roof, and the only way out is back through the archway. There's a lot of courtyard to cross with them firing from high ground. Even if we make it, I'm guessing they're going to have plenty more thunder waiting for us outside the bulk spleen. Unless Kaz and Matthias can somehow clear a path.
I know another way out, said Wylan. But the entrance is on the other side of the courtyard.
He pointed to a door beneath an arch carved with some kind of horned monster gnawing on a pencil.
The reading room.
Jesper gauged the distance.
All right. On three. You make a break. I'll cover you. Get my father inside.
Jesper!
Da. I swear, I'll explain everything. But right now, all you need to know is that we're in a bad situation. And bad situations happen to be my area of expertise.
And it was true.
Jesper could feel himself coming alive. The worry that had been dogging his steps since he'd gotten news of his father's arrival in Ketterdam falling away.
He felt free. Dangerous.
like lightning rolling over the prairie. Trust me, Da.
All right, boy. All right.
Jesper was pretty sure he could hear an unspoken, for now. He saw Wyland brace himself. The Merchling was still so new to all this. Hopefully, Jesper wouldn't get everyone killed.
One, two,
he started firing on three. Leaping into the courtyard, he rolled for cover behind the fountain. He'd gone in blind, but he picked out the shapes on the roof quickly, aiming by instinct, sensing movement and firing before he could think his way clear of a good shot. He didn't need to kill anyone. He just needed to scare the hell out of them, and buy Wylan and his father time. A bullet struck the fountain's central statue, the book in the scholar's hand exploding into fragments of stone. Whatever ammunition they were using, they weren't messing around. Jesper reloaded and popped up from behind the fountain shooting.
All saints!
He shouted as pain tore through his shoulder. He really hated being shot. He shrank back behind the stone lip. He flexed his hand, testing the damage to his arm. Just a scratch, but it hurt like hell, and he was bleeding all over his new tweed jacket. This is why it doesn't pay to try to look respectable, he muttered. Above him, he could see the silhouettes on the roof moving. Any minute, they were going to circle around the other side of the fountain, and he'd be done for.
Jesper!
Wyland's voice.
Damn it, he was supposed to get clear. Jesper, at your 2 o'clock!
Jesper looked up, and something was arcing through the sky. Without thinking, he aimed and fired. The air exploded.
Get in the water!
Wyland shouted. Jesper dove into the fountain, and a second later, the air sizzled with light. When Jesper poked his soaked head out of the water, he saw that every exposed surface of the courtyard and its gardens was pocked with holes, tendrils of smoke rising from the tiny craters. Whoever was up on the roof was screaming. Just what kind of bomb had Wyland let loose? He hoped Matthias and Kaz had found cover, but there was no time to stew on it. He bolted for the doorway beneath the pencil-chewing demon. Wyland and his father were waiting inside. They slammed the door shut.
Help me, said Jesper. We need to barricade the entrance.
The man behind the desk wore gray scholar's robes. His nostrils were flared so wide in effrontery that Jesper feared being sucked up one of them.
Young man,
Jesper pointed his gun at the scholar's chest.
Move. Jesper,
his father said.
Don't worry, Da. People point guns at each other all the time in Ketterdam. It's basically a handshake.
Is that true?
His father asked, as the scholar grudgingly moved aside, and they shoved the heavy desk in front of the door.
Absolutely, said Wylan.
Certainly not, said the scholar.
Jesper waved them on.
Depends on the neighborhood. Let's go.
They pelted down the main aisle of the reading room between long tables lit by lamps with curving necks. Students huddled against the wall and under the chairs, probably thinking they were all about to die.
Nothing to worry about, everyone, Jesper called. Just a little target practice in the courtyard.
This way,
said Wylan, ushering them through a door covered in elaborate scroll work.
Oh, you mustn't,
said the scholar, rushing after them, robes flapping.
Not the rare books room.
Do you want to shake hands again? Jesper asked, then added, I promise we won't shoot anything we don't have to. He gave his father a gentle shove. Up the stairs.
Jesper,
said a voice from beneath the nearest table. A pretty blonde girl looked up from where she was crouched on the floor.
Madeline?
Jesper said.
Madeline, Michaud? You said we'd have breakfast.
I have to go to Fierda.
Fierda?
Jesper headed up the stairs after Wylan, then poked his head back into the reading room.
If I live, I'll buy you waffles.
You don't have enough money to buy her waffles.
Wylan grumbled.
Be quiet, we're in a library.
Jesper had never had cause to enter the rare books room while he was at school. The silence was so deep, it was like being underwater. Illuminated manuscripts were displayed in glass cases lit by golden falls of lamplight, and rare maps covered the walls. A squalor, in a blue kefta, stood in the corner, arms raised, but shrank back as they entered.
"Shoo!"
the squalor cried when he saw Wylan.
"I won't go with you. I'll kill myself first."
Jesper's father held up his hands as if gentling a horse.
"Easy, lad."
"We're just passing through," said Jesper, giving his father another push.
"Follow me," said Wylan. "What is a squalor doing in the rare books room?"
Jesper asked as they raced through the labyrinth of shelves and cases, past the occasional scholar or student crouched against the books in fear.
"Humidity. He keeps the air dry to preserve the manuscripts."
"Nice work if you can get it."
When they reached the westernmost wall, Wylan stopped in front of a map of Ravka. He looked around to make sure they weren't being observed, then pressed the symbol marking the capital, Os Alta. The country seemed to tear apart along the seams of the unsee, revealing a dark gap, barely wide enough to squeeze through.
"It leads to the second floor of a printmaker's shop," said Wylan as they edged inside. "It was built as a way for professors to get from the library to their homes without having to deal with angry students."
"Angry?" Jesper's father said. "Do all the students have guns?"
"No, but there's a long-standing tradition of rioting over grades."
The map slid closed, leaving them in the dark as they shuffled along sideways.
"Not to be a podge," Jesper murmured to Wylan, "but I wouldn't have thought you'd know your way around the rare books room."
"I used to meet with one of my tutors here, back when my father still thought." The tutor had a lot of interesting stories, and I always liked the maps. Tracing the letters sometimes made it easier to... It's how I found the passage.
"You know, Wylan, one of these days I'm going to stop underestimating you."
There was a brief pause, and then, from somewhere up ahead, he heard Wylan say,
"Then you're going to be a lot harder to surprise."
Jesper grinned, but it didn't quite feel right. From behind them, he could hear shouting from the rare books room. It had been a close call. He was bleeding from his shoulder. They'd made a grand escape. These were the moments he lived for. He should be buzzing from the excitement of the fight. The thrill was still there, fizzing through his blood. But beside it was a cold, unfamiliar sensation that felt like it was draining the joy from him. All he could think was, Da could have been hurt. He could have died. Jesper was used to people shooting at him. He would have been a little insulted if they'd stopped shooting at him. This was different. His father hadn't chosen this fight. His only crime had been putting his faith in his son.
That's the problem with Ketterdam, Jesper thought, as they stumbled uncertainly through the dark.
Trusting the wrong person can get you killed.
6. Nina couldn't stop staring at Colm Fahey. He was a bit shorter than his son, broader in the shoulders, his coloring classically Kalish, vibrant dark red hair and that salt-white skin, densely clouded with freckles by the Zemini sun. And though his eyes were the same clear gray as Jesper's, they had a seriousness to them, a kind of sure warmth that differed from Jesper's crackling energy. It wasn't only the pleasure of trying to find Jesper in his father's features that kept Nina's attention focused on the farmer. There was just something so strange about seeing a person that wholesome, standing in the stone hall of an empty mausoleum, surrounded by Ketterdam's worst, herself among them. Nina shivered, and drew the old horse blanket she'd been using as a wrap more tightly around her. She'd started tallying her life in good days and bad days, and thanks to the Cornelis Smeet job, this was turning out to be a very bad day. She couldn't afford to let it get the best of her. Not when they were this close to rescuing Inej. "Be all right," Nina willed silently, hoping her thoughts could somehow cut through the air, speed over the waters of the Ketterdam harbors, and reach her friend. Stay safe and whole, and wait for us. Nina hadn't been on Velgaluk when Vanek had taken an Edge hostage. She'd still been trying to purge the Parem from her body, caught in the haze of suffering that had begun on the voyage from Jerholm. She told herself to be grateful for the memory of that misery, every shaking, aching, vomiting minute of it. The shame of Matthias witnessing it all, holding back her hair, dabbing her brow, restraining her as gently as he could as she argued, cajoled, screamed at him for more Parem. She made herself remember every terrible thing she'd said, every wild pleasure offered, each insult or accusation she'd hurled at him. You enjoy watching me suffer. You want me to beg, don't you? How long have you been waiting to see me like this? Stop punishing me, Matthias. Help me. Be good to me, and I'll be good to you. He'd absorbed it all in stoic silence. She clutched tight to those memories. She needed them as vivid and bright and cringe-inducing as possible to fight her hunger for the drug. She never wanted to be like that again. Now she looked at Matthias, his hair coming in thick and gold, long enough that it was just starting to curl over his ears. She loved the sight of him, and she hated it too, because he wouldn't give her what she wanted, because he knew how badly she needed it. After Kaz had settled them on Black Veil, Nina had managed to last 2 days before she'd broken down and gone to Kuwei to ask him for another dose of Parem. A small one, just a taste of it, something to ease this relentless need. The sweats were gone, the bouts of fever. She could walk and talk, and listen to Kaz and the others hatching their plans. But even as she went about her business, drank the cups of broth and tea heaped with sugar that Matthias set before her, the need was there. A ceaseless, serrated sawing at her nerves, back and forth, minute to minute. She hadn't made a conscious decision to ask Kuei when she'd sat down beside him. She'd spoken to him softly in Shu, listened to him complain about the dampness of the tomb. And then the words were out of her mouth. Do you have any more? He didn't bother to ask what she meant. I gave it all to Matthias. I see, she'd said. That's probably for the best. She'd smiled. He'd smiled. She'd wanted to claw his face to shreds. Because she couldn't possibly go to Matthias. Ever. And for all she knew, he'd thrown whatever supply of the drug Kuei had into the sea. The thought filled her with so much panic that she'd had to race outside and vomit the spare contents of her stomach in front of one of the ruined mausoleums. She'd covered the mess with dirt, then found a quiet place to sit beneath a trellis of ivy, and wept in jags of unsteady tears. You're all a bunch of useless skivs, she'd said to the silent graves. They didn't seem to care. And yet somehow the stillness of Black Veil comforted her, quieted her. She couldn't explain why. The places of the dead had never held solace for her before. She rested for a while, dried her tears, and when she knew she wouldn't give herself away with blotchy skin and watery eyes, she'd made her way back to the others. You survived the worst of it, she had told herself. The Parem is out of reach, and now you can stop thinking about it. And she'd managed, for a while. Then last night, when she'd been preparing to cozy up to Cornelis Smeet, she'd made the mistake of using her power. Even with the wig and the flowers and the costume and the corset, she hadn't quite felt up to the role of seductress. So she'd found a looking glass inside Club Cumulus and attempted to tailor the circles beneath her eyes. It was the first time she'd tried to use her power since her recovery. She'd broken into a sweat from the effort, and as soon as the bruised color faded, the hunger for Parem hit. A swift, hard kick to her chest. She'd bent double, clutching the sink, her mind filled with breakneck thoughts of how she could get away, who might have a supply, what she could trade. She forced herself to think of the shame on the boat, the future she might be able to make with Matthias. But the thought that had brought her back to sanity was Inej. She owed Inej her life, and there was no way she was leaving her stranded with Vanek. She wasn't that person. She refused to be. Somehow, she had pulled herself together. She splashed water on her face, pinched her cheeks to pinkness. She still looked haggard, but with resolution she'd hitched up her corset and flashed the brightest smile she could muster. "Do this right, and Smeet won't be looking at your face," Nina had told herself, and she'd sailed out the doors to snag herself a pigeon. But once the job was done, when the information they needed was secured, and everyone had fallen asleep, she'd dug through Matthias's few belongings, through the pockets of his clothes, her frustration growing with every passing second. She hated him. She hated Kue. She hated this stupid city. Disgusted with herself, she'd slipped beneath his blankets. Matthias always slept with his back to a wall, a habit from his days in Hellgate. She'd let her hands wander, seeking his pockets, trying to feel along the linings of his trousers.
"Nina?"
he'd asked sleepily. "I'm cold," she said, her hands continuing their search. She pressed a kiss to his neck, then below his ear. She'd never let herself kiss him this way before. She'd never had the chance. They'd been too busy untangling the skein of suspicion and lust and loyalty that bound them together. And once she'd taken the Perem, it was all she could think of. Even now, the desire she felt was for the drug, not for the body she felt shift beneath her hands. She didn't kiss his lips, though. She wouldn't let Perem take that from her, too. He'd groaned slightly.
"The others?"
"Everyone is asleep." Then he'd seized her hands.
"Stop."
"Matthias..."
"I don't have it."
She yanked herself free, shame crawling over her skin like fire over a forest floor. "Then who does?" she hissed.
"Kaz."
She stilled.
"Are you going to creep into his bed?"
Nina released a huff of disbelief. "He'd slit my throat." She wanted to scream her helplessness. There would be no bargaining with Kaz. She couldn't bully him the way she might have bullied Wylan or plead with him the way she might have managed Jesper. Fatigue came on suddenly, a yoke at her neck, the exhaustion at least tempering her frantic need. She rested her forehead against Matthias's chest. "I hate this," she said. "I hate you a little, Druskella."
"I'm used to it. Come here."
He'd wrapped his arms around her and got her talking about Ravka, about Inej. He'd distracted her with stories, named the winds that blew across Fjerda. Told her of his first meal in the Druskella Hall. At some point, she must have drifted off, because the next thing she knew, she was burrowing her way out of a heavy, dreamless sleep, woken by the sound of the tomb door slamming open. Matthias and Kaz had returned from the university, holes burned into their clothing from some kind of bomb Wylan had made. Jesper and Wylan close on their heels, wild-eyed and soaked from the spring rain that had begun to fall. With a beefy, Kalish-looking farmer in tow. Nina felt like she'd been given some kind of lovely gift from the saints. A situation mad and baffling enough to actually distract her. Though the hunger for Perem had dulled since last night's frenzy, it was still there. And she had no idea how she was going to get through the mission tonight. Seducing Smeet had only been the first part of their plan. Kaz was counting on her. Inej was counting on her. They needed her to be a Corporalnik, not an addict with the shakes who wore herself out with the barest bit of tailoring. But Nina couldn't think about any of that, with Calm Fahey standing there mangling his hat, and Jesper looking like he'd rather be eating a stack of waffles topped with ground glass than facing him. And Kaz. She had no idea what to expect from Kaz. Anger. Maybe worse. Kaz didn't like surprises or potential vulnerabilities, and Jesper's father was one very stocky, wind-chafed vulnerability. But after hearing Jesper's breathless and, Nina suspected, abbreviated description of how they'd escaped the university, Kaz simply leaned on his cane and said,
"Were you followed?"
"No,"
Jesper replied with a decisive shake of his head.
"Wylan?"
Colm bristled.
"You doubt my son's word."
"It isn't personal, Da,"
said Jesper.
"He doubts everyone's word."
Kaz's expression had been unruffled, his rough stone voice so easy and pleasant that Nina felt the hair rise on her arms.